KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201 DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. U.S. tariffs went into effect against China overnight. China imposed a range of responses, and a trade war with Mexico and Canada is on pause for now. Where we stand in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. What's the case for the U.S. Agency for International Development? I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Stephen Skeep. Also, what's the case against it? We have the story of an agency Elon Musk said he was closing, and the Secretary of State says he is reforming. Also, who prevailed when oligarchs moved into Russia's government? And we have an early report from the scene of the Super Bowl. It's Tuesday, February 4th. This day in 1789, electors chose George Washington as president. Now his picture decorates a car wash I saw yesterday in the nation's capital, and my kid called it a car Washington. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is scheduled to hold talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports the meeting comes at a crucial time for the ceasefire in Gaza.
Netanyahu was invited to the White House by Trump, the first foreign leader to visit Trump since he began his second term. The two leaders have much to discuss, like the Abraham Accords and the normalization of relations with Saudi Arabia and how to deal with Iran. But most immediately is Gaza, as talks of the next phase of the fragile ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas begin this week, with the U.S. acting as a key mediator. Trump has also recently floated the very controversial idea of relocating Palestinians from Gaza to neighboring Egypt or Jordan, something Palestinians, Egypt, and Jordan all reject. Netanyahu and Trump are expected to hold a press conference later this evening after they meet. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The government efficiency cost-cutting team led by tech billionaire Elon Musk is facing continued backlash for gaining access to a federal payment system at the Treasury Department. Natasha Sarin was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at Treasury during the Biden administration. She says she can't think of a legitimate reason why Musk has access to the system.
What you're talking about here is that Elon Musk and Doge can be in charge of deciding what programs they want to keep paying out and what Social Security beneficiaries should keep getting their benefits.
Two federal government employee unions and the Alliance for Retired Americans have filed a lawsuit against Elon Musk and Doge. The suit claims that they are illegally accessing the personal information of government workers and taxpayers. Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning after President Trump dialed back the opening salvo in his trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow slipped 12 points in early trading.
Investors breathed a sigh of relief after Trump agreed to suspend 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada for at least a month. The move came after the two countries made face-saving concessions to strengthen border security. The Trump administration followed through, however, with a smaller 10% tax on imports from China, which took effect just after midnight. China's pushing back by taxing U.S. exports of coal, crude oil, and natural gas, and by launching a new antitrust investigation of Google. Stock in Pepsi lost a little fizz after the soft drink and snack giant reported disappointing quarterly sales. Pepsi's repeated price hikes have prompted some shoppers to switch to cheaper store brand chips and soda pop. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are trading mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow is down 5 points. The Nasdaq Composite up 162. The S&P up 21 points. This is NPR. Recent wildfires in Los Angeles County have left thousands of farm workers laboring in unhealthy air pollution. NPR's Nate Perez reports these workers have limited protections to help with smoke inhalation.
Smoke from the Hughes Fire in late January quickly spread to Ventura County, where thousands of farm workers pick strawberries, citrus, and other produce. Nonprofits scrambled to get around 21,000 N95 respirators to people in the fields. Elizabeth Strader with the United Farm Workers says workers are concerned about their health, but have no choice but to work.
And there are long-term effects. You know, we know that it damages the heart. We know that it damages their lungs.
Employers in California are legally required to provide N95 respirators to workers when the air quality index reaches 150. Oregon and Washington are the only other states that also have this requirement. Nate Perez, NPR News.
The University of California system is being sued for alleged racial discrimination. A group called Students Against Racial Discrimination is accusing 9 of the university's campuses of favoring Black and Latino applicants over what it calls better qualified white and Asian American applicants. In a statement, the university said its undergraduate admissions applications collect data on students' race and ethnicity for statistical purposes only, and that they are not used for admission. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 5 points, the Nasdaq up 177. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, as vaped marijuana grows in popularity, we'll take a look at what's in it and how safe it is if you happen to partake.
We begin with the tariffs that are and are not in effect. The United States did go ahead overnight and impose U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. China has already retaliated.
After President Trump's administration imposed 10% taxes on Chinese exports to the U.S., China responded with 15% taxes on U.S. goods. China also put export controls on vital metals like tungsten.
Now, the trade war with Mexico and Canada is paused for now after the president made threats that jolted relations with a close U.S. ally. So how does all this look from Canada? NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam is in Ottawa. Jackie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So how did the United States and Canada at least put off a confrontation?
Well, you know, it did come right down to the wire. The Trump's tariffs against Canada were set to go into effect 1 minute after midnight, and that's the same for Mexico. And Canada was bracing for it, you know. It had already announced it would retaliate by imposing 25% tariffs on $100 billion of U.S. goods. But earlier on Monday, Trump struck a deal with Mexico and then with Canada, and both sides said they would send thousands of troops to their borders to curb the illegal flow of migrants and fentanyl, which is what Trump had asked for. But, you know, Ottawa says the amount of fentanyl coming across from Canada is a fraction of that coming from Mexico, which has led to a lot of questions here in Canada of what this was really about. Why impose high tariffs on the country, which is one of, you know, the closest allies of the U.S.?
Yeah, I am thinking the Canadians made new measures at their border before the threat of tariffs. Mm-hmm. Now they've made even more, apparently, or promised something, and still the threat of tariffs hangs over them for 30 days. How are people responding?
Oh, you know, I've been talking with Canadians for the past couple of weeks since Trump first announced he was going to do this, and the responses have been anger and disbelief and really wanting to hit back. You know, there's a campaign that got underway to avoid buying any American products here, and Canadians were booing during the singing of the Star-Spangled Banner at major sporting events. And liquor stores in some provinces were going to pull American bourbon and wine from their shelves. And, you know, I dropped in at a liquor store here in Ottawa last night, and one of the workers, Ryan Robinson, said they were all ready to remove American bourbon off the shelves. Here he is.
We felt betrayed. I think we thought, you know, our closest ally in the world was stabbing us in the back a little bit, right? I think Trump is blowing things out of proportion a little bit. So I don't really understand his reasoning to start such a trade war.
And, you know, Steve, Canada is one of the U.S. largest trading partners. But, you know, it's more than that. This feels personal up here, especially when Trump keeps saying he wants to turn Canada into the 51st state.
Yeah, which I think people took as a joke when Trump first said that, but he keeps saying it again and again and again. So how do the two countries move forward?
Well, you know, this is only a month-long reprieve, and I think it's fair to say that there is a trust deficit between Canada and the U.S., and the U.S. and Mexico, for that matter. Canada faced a serious threat of recession if Trump's tariffs went ahead. You know, there's a fear that it's not over, at least for now. And as you mentioned, Steve, the threat of a trade war goes beyond North America as the U.S. and China launch these tit-for-tat tariffs on each other. The White House says Trump is due to talk to Chinese leader Xi Jinping today, but negotiations between the rivals, you know, could be a drawn-out process.
NPR's Jackie Northam, thanks so much for your work.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, some changes are underway at the U.S. Department of Education with bigger potential moves on the horizon.
Sources tell NPR that President Trump is getting ready to issue an executive action that would do two things: move quickly to make relatively small staff and program cuts, and call on Congress to close the department entirely. This comes as several dozen of the department's 4,400 workers have already been placed on paid leave.
NPR's Corey Turner joins us now. Tori, good morning. Corey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
NPR's Tori Kerner. Anyway, Corey, good morning. By your proper name, what do you know about this executive action?
Well, and not a lot, at least not through official channels. The White House did not respond to a request for comment, but multiple sources have told me, folks who are not allowed to speak publicly, the Trump administration is eager to close the department. And so in the near term, it plans to use this executive action to try to move quickly to cut programs and staff that were not created by Congress. So they're not protected by law. The idea being these will be the programs that are the easiest to cut, essentially the low-hanging fruit. The problem here, Steve, is the department itself and its signature responsibilities were all created by Congress, and so they're much harder to cut.
Unless, of course, you operate within the rule of law and go to Congress and ask them to reconsider that. So what are the responsibilities that could be targeted by executive action?
Yeah, so the department has a budget of around $79 billion. On the K-12 side, it administers Title I, which sends extra funding to schools in lower-income communities, both urban and rural. And it administers IDEA, that's the civil rights law that guarantees special education. And obviously on the higher ed side, it manages the $1.6 trillion student loan portfolio. Now, I have spoken with a bunch of experts over the past year who all say they really don't see how a president can make meaningful legal changes to these programs without Congress. And that's why, Steve, I'm hearing from my sources that this executive action would essentially acknowledge that by calling on Congress to either cut or move some or all of these programs to other agencies. The challenge for the administration is there have been plenty of past efforts to close the department and rewrite the rules of big programs like Title I, but lawmakers, including many Republicans, have always opposed them.
Although that's the system. That's checks and balances. That's the Constitution. So what you're saying is we expect an executive order that really is just a statement asking Congress to do what the president asks, which is the way the Constitution works. At the same time, you're reporting that some education department staff are being placed on leave. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. At least 74 non-management Department of Education staff have been placed on paid administrative leave. They all got this email in the last few days saying they're being placed on leave because of President Trump's executive action targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. In a statement I got, a department spokesperson said, quote, "We are evaluating staffing in line with a commitment to prioritizing meaningful learning ahead of divisive ideology in schools and putting student outcomes above special interests." But I spoke yesterday and last night with a bunch of these employees, and they all told me they don't work in DEI. They're career staff. They work in multiple departments. The only thing they had in common was that they had all attended at some point a DEI workshop the department has been offering for years, including, by the way, going back to the first Trump administration.
Okay. NPR's Corey Turner will continue listening for your reporting on that. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Marijuana sales are increasing as it becomes legally available in more places across the country, and that includes vaped weed. Now, that's a liquid version that's vaporized and inhaled. And if you use it, you might have wondered what's actually in it, and how does the safety of these products compare to conventional smoked marijuana? As part of our series, How Safe Is Your Weed?, NPR's Yuki Noguchi has looked into this.
Vaping pot from an e-cigarette can be relatively odorless and discreet compared to smoking dried marijuana flower. And Aaron Smith, CEO of the National Cannabis Industry Association, says that's why vaping is increasingly the preferred method of consumption.
We're definitely seeing an increase in sales for vapes and a decrease in flower.
Smith, as well as some researchers, posit that vaping pot, much like nicotine, is potentially easier on the lungs than smoking because the vaporized liquid inside is heated to lower temperatures that may do less harm. On the other hand, much is still unknown. Research on the health effects of pot is sparse because it remains federally illegal. Plus, no two vapes are alike. The huge variety of products on shelves today contain many other chemicals that make each different. And often, it's those other chemicals that prove problematic. In 2019, for example, 68 people died and thousands of others fell ill with mysterious lung damage eventually traced to e-cigarettes laced with pot and an additive called vitamin E acetate. Smith says that's where legalization and regulation are helpful.
And that's why there are regulations in every state that has legal cannabis to ensure that these products are tested, dangerous chemicals are not used in the process.
But Josh Sweeter says his own safety testing of vapes shows many chemicals are evading those regulations. He's CEO of Infinite Chemical Analysis Labs, a company that chemically evaluates marijuana products in all their forms. He says states that allow marijuana to be sold also screen for up to 66 pesticides. Yet there are thousands of other pesticides that growers or processors use, and he's found many of those in the country's pot supply.
When you concentrate your flower cannabis into a concentrate, most pesticides come over and concentrate during that same procedure.
Sweeter says dangers are not limited to the drugs extracted from the marijuana plant. He says in many markets, THC, the psychoactive ingredient in pot, is made synthetically through a chemical process that leaves behind residue. He says about a quarter of those contain a corrosive, toxic chemical similar to sulfuric acid.
Cannabis and this synthetic stuff, it's like an endless supply of possible contaminants.
Deepak Cyril D'Souza is a psychiatry professor at Yale who's researched THC for three decades. He has other concerns about vaping, too, namely their potency.
The amount of THC that's present in these concentrates is far in excess of what average weed contains.
He says today, the average cannabis flower contains about 17 or 18% THC, where the concentration in vape pens is often five times higher. And that, D'Souza says, has other implications for public health, especially among teenagers and young adults.
The young brain is much more vulnerable to addiction. Concentrates are more likely to get people addicted to it.
And as pot goes more mainstream, he says, that's a message that's often drowned out. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
popular. You're gonna be popular.
On the next Fresh Air, our guest will be Ariana Grande. The Grammy-winning pop star is nominated for an Oscar for her role as Galinda in Wicked. She started acting on Broadway and TV when she was in her teens. Join us.
You'll hang with the right cohorts. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, 'cause you've got...
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a story this morning of oligarchy.
I don't think we're witnessing the start of an oligarchy. I think we are fully here.
Democratic lawmaker Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that on Instagram after President Trump's election. Trump ally Steve Bannon used the word oligarchs on NPR.
These oligarchs in the Silicon Valley, they have a very different view of how people should govern themselves. I call it techno-feudalism.
Tech billionaires were on stage for Trump's inauguration, which critics took as a sign of their influence, and Bannon took as a sign that Trump had broken them. Their prominence leads to a question of what we might learn from another country where a few wealthy men grew very close to political power. David Hoffman knows that country, Russia. He lived there and wrote about it starting in the 1990s when Russia had a democratic government and a few super rich men, popularly known as oligarchs.
When Soviet Union collapsed as a state and as a political system, it left on the ground this vast archipelago of factories and mines, of refineries, of natural resources. And the question was, who would inherit it? The really ones who began to inherit it in the early 1990s were these young hustlers, kids who had not been part of the Communist Party, and seven of them became prominent businessmen by glomming on to these big, valuable assets during the period of privatization.
So they effectively inherited or seized factories, oil companies, energy assets, all kinds of different things.
Timber, diamonds, oil, you name it.
Hoffman says it wasn't just wealth that made them oligarchs. It was the way that they profited from the state and also influenced the state. They played a big role ensuring the re-election of President Boris Yeltsin in 1996. But then, just at the start of a new century, Russia got a new president, Vladimir Putin, who began to change the story.
The oligarchs were not really very popular in Russia. There was some real resentment among the Russian people about, you know, what had happened. And when Putin came in, his attitude was very much reflective of this envy and resentment in the population. He said at the beginning, "I will eliminate the oligarchs as a class." He said, "This is how I see it. The state holds a club, which it uses only once, and the blow connects with the head. We have not used the club yet. We have only shown it, and the gesture suffice to get everyone's attention. If we get angry, however, we will use the club without hesitation."
So what did Putin do when he decided to swing the club? How did that come about?
Well, he decided basically to chase the oligarchs out of the country or take their assets. Very early on, two of the most prominent of the first generation, Vladimir Gusinsky, who was a real entrepreneur, who had been at a television station and a prominent newspaper, forced out. Boris Berezovsky, who had helped make Yeltsin and was even involved in picking Putin and had the biggest television station, forced out. And then in 2003, he had a big roundtable with all the remaining businessmen. And at this roundtable, one of the remaining oligarchs, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, made a comment that suggested that the Kremlin was trying to extract a big payoff in an oil company sale. And Putin was furious. And this remark was followed by Khodorkovsky's arrest.
What happened to the remaining oligarchs after the first several were arrested or disappeared?
They were cowed into staying out of Putin's way. Furthermore, as time went by, Putin didn't change the system. What he did was he installed his own people as oligarchs. He changed the guy sitting in the chairs, but he didn't change the chairs.
I note that when you talked about oligarchs being picked off at the beginning, people with media assets were picked off at the beginning. Why was that?
Because this was their power. You have to remember the Russian people and the whole Soviet experience were exposed to media that was all directed by the state, right? They were pummeled by propaganda for years. And so in the first decade of freedom, and believe me, Yeltsin brought them the most freedom that Russians had experienced in their history. Mm-hmm. In that first decade, seeing a free, independent media was very powerful.
It seems to me that you're describing a pattern where, at the beginning, these oligarchs were woven in with the government, but they were independent sources of wealth and power. And by the end of this narrative that you've told, there's really only one power center, and everybody in it is there to support the one guy and the one-man rule.
I would put it this way. Capitalism evolves. It's like biology. And at the very beginning, when they pulled the plug on the Soviet system, people were grabbing things, and it was without a rule of law. And the hope of that period was it would mature and evolve into a more Western system. That hope stopped in 2000 when Putin came to power.
We now have a government of the United States where, we shouldn't kid ourselves, very wealthy people have always held outsized influence. But now you have this class of people that is being described as oligarchs, and many of them were on stage with the new president at the inauguration. What lessons, if any, from that Russian story that you have learned apply here and now?
Steve, I think that capitalism needs the ability to get rich. What changed, though, is when they get involved as unelected power brokers, when they pull the levers from behind the scenes, then they become unaccountable. And this is the danger. Not that they are sitting at the inaugural or at a ball or even visiting the White House. Remember, Ronald Reagan had a kitchen cabinet of wealthy guys that he liked to pal around with every once in a while. Mm-hmm. That's not the problem. But when they begin to make decisions, that's a merger of wealth and power that warps our democracy. And I really worry about the lack of accountability, because they don't have a legitimacy in our elected system. And that's the very, very dangerous part of this.
David Hoffman is a contributing editor to The Washington Post and author of the book, The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. Thanks for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
A progressive pastor at a North Carolina church spent years promoting racial justice and has repeatedly called out Donald Trump.
Where do we go from here? We go back to the beginning. We do what our ancestors have done. We get up and we walk toward the tomb, because the fight's not over, it's just beginning.
But within weeks of the November election, the pastor was asked to leave. We investigate what happened on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Moments ago, the Senate Finance Committee approved Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. The vote was along party lines. Kennedy's nomination now moves to the full Senate for a confirmation vote. President Trump's entity tasked with slashing federal spending is being sued by two government employee unions and the Alliance for Retired Americans. They claim Elon Musk, who's leading the effort by DOGE, is illegally accessing the personal information of federal workers and taxpayers, as NPR's Bobby Allen reports.
DOGE is analyzing payment systems at the Treasury Department. Elon Musk calls some of Treasury's trillions of dollars in annual payments criminal, though on what basis is not clear. Now a lawsuit is asking a court to block DOGE's Treasury access, saying Social Security and disability benefits, tax returns, and the private information of federal government employees are at risk. Lawyer Noam Eisen is representing the plaintiffs.
We filed a lawsuit to say, hands off. You can't have my data. You can't have my spouse's data. You can't have my kids' data. That information is too precious.
President Trump has said Musk's work has required the explicit approval of the White House. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street are mostly higher this morning. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is due at the White House today for talks with President Trump. They're expected to talk about the next phase of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. That deal took effect the day before Trump was sworn in for a second term. Since then, Hamas has been releasing Israeli hostages, and Israel has been freeing Palestinian prisoners and detainees. A judge in Georgia is dismissing one of two charges against a former prosecutor accused of interfering with a murder investigation. As NPR's Debbie Elliott reports, the case involved the 2020 killing of a black jogger, Ahmaud Arbery, by three white men.
Ruling from the bench, senior judge John Turner said there was, quote, not one scintilla of evidence supporting an obstruction charge against former Brunswick District Attorney Jackie Johnson. She still faces a felony charge of violating her oath of office. Prosecutors with the Georgia State Attorney General's office say Johnson sought to shield Arbery's killers from arrest. One of them had previously worked as an investigator in her office. The judge's directed verdict came after prosecutors rested their case, having presented no testimony that Johnson tried to influence police. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 19 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Hundreds of workers for the U.S. Agency for International Development have been laid off or put on leave. Nearly all programs funded by the agency have been frozen by Elon Musk's efforts to shrink the federal government. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he is now the acting director of USAID. He told reporters that some USAID programs will continue to function.
But everything they do has to be in alignment with the national interest and the foreign policy of the United States.
USAID spends tens of billions of dollars a year on humanitarian aid around the world. But since the agency is not that well known outside of policy circles, we thought it would be helpful to take a few minutes to hear about USAID's history, what it does, and how that fits into U.S. foreign policy goals. We've called George Ingram for this because he's worked on international economic and development policy in Congress, the executive branch, and in the nonprofit world. He's now with the Brookings Institution, which is a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. Good morning, Mr. Ingram. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So President John F. Kennedy created the agency in 1961. How is it meant to advance U.S. interests?
It advances interests in three ways. It promotes our humanitarian values by responding to humanitarian crises around the world. Secondly, it advances our economic interests by helping develop markets where the United States can trade and invest. And third, it promotes our national security by helping promote stability around the world, both political stability and regional stability in developing countries.
So this isn't the first time that the agency's role has been questioned or even that it's been proposed to be folded into the State Department. Why is that?
There was a major effort in the mid-1990s to merge three smaller agencies into state. Two of them were merged, and after extensive, several years conversation between the Congress and the executive branch, it was determined to retain USAID as an independent agency because they wanted some separation from foreign policy. Foreign policy tends to be short-term transactional objectives with a government, whereas development is long-term work on the social, economic, and political milieu in other countries and needs to have that independence, not total independence from foreign policy because it receives foreign policy guidance from the Secretary of State, but some independence from the day-to-day machinations of foreign policy.
So is one issue here that some people, I'm assuming that some people think maybe its mission overlaps with others, but is it mainly that there's a core group that just does not like the idea of foreign aid?
There's always been a small cadre in America who don't like the idea of foreign aid. But over the last 25 years, the annual foreign assistance bill has passed with overwhelmingly bipartisan support in the Congress.
So what the other issue seems to be that there's a sense that this agency is just too independent. Now, when he spoke with reporters yesterday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio criticized USAID staff for being, quote, completely uncooperative when asked questions about what its programs do. Let's listen.
Their attitude is, we don't have to answer to you because we are independent. We answer to no one. Well, that's not true, and that will no longer be the case.
So let's account for some rhetorical flourish, but is there something to that? Is there a sense that this agency just runs on its own imperatives?
No. USAID has always fallen under the general foreign policy guidance of the National Security Council and the State Department and the President, of course. Secondly, it has a cadre of political appointees at the top who are appointed by an administration to pursue their policies. And the career staff at AID basically implements the policies that are set and determined by the political leaders of the agency.
So there seems to be more to it than that. Hope we'll talk again. That's George Ingram with the Brookings Institution. Mr. Ingram, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, the Super Bowl comes Sunday, and the festivities are underway in New Orleans, or New Orleans, or New Orleans, or Narlins. Take your choice. NPR's Becky Sullivan went to the Superdome, or Superdome, last night and sent back this story.
In 6 days, this stadium will host the big game. But on Monday night, it was transformed for the spectacle that is Super Bowl opening night. Every player from the Philadelphia Eagles and the Kansas City Chiefs was there, dressed in matching white tracksuits, making the rounds to talk to the media. For thousands of fans, it was a chance to get autographs. For social media personalities, a chance to ask silly questions.
Now, can we compare hand sizes?
What color is the Gatorade going to be on Sunday?
And it's New Orleans, so of course there was a marching band. The Eagles and the Chiefs have competing goals for the game, of course, but on Monday the players expressed something they shared, gratitude, for reaching a moment that they've been working toward their entire lives. For Philadelphia's Keely Ringo, it hit him the moment he arrived.
soon as I walked in, I'm like, man, older Keeley's really living young Keeley's dreams. It's such a great feeling, man. Just, man, I'm extremely blessed, highly favored, man.
For some of the Chiefs, you can multiply that feeling by three. They're the first team in NFL history to return to the Super Bowl after winning two in a row. That was beyond the wildest dreams of third-year defensive back Joshua Williams because, well, his dreams weren't that elaborate.
It was me going in my rookie year and winning the Super Bowl, and I never went past that. So the fact that we've done it a second year and made it here the third year and we're planning to accomplish the big feat of winning the third one is a blessing.
That run got going with a Super Bowl win back in 2023 when the Chiefs beat the Eagles 38-35. So this year's a rematch. The familiarity between the two teams runs even deeper than that. Kansas City head coach Andy Reid first held that job in Philly for 14 years, and among his mentees there was Howie Roseman. He's now the Eagles' general manager, and he had some gratitude of his own to express on Monday.
I'm very fortunate, I feel, like to be able to have spent the first 13 years of my career with Coach Reid and learn from him and him take the time to watch tape with me and explain to me why he was doing things. You know, I would definitely not be in this position if it wasn't from him, and that's where it starts.
So between these two teams, it's all compliments for now. Sunday, back here at the Superdome, will be a different story. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, New Orleans.
So, I don't know, Michelle. I mean, I don't have, like, it's not like one of my teams is in the Super Bowl, but I like Kansas City just because I like Kansas City, you know?
Well, look, this country's polarized enough, so I'm not taking sides. All I'm going to say is our colleague Juana Summers is from Kansas City, and so I'm afraid of her, so I'm not going to say.
I'm not going to say I'm for the Eagles, says Michelle, while making it clear that she's for the Eagles.
No, I'm all about the snacks, Steve.
The snacks are important.
Snacks.
Taylor Swift, big part of the story here. Travis Kelce reveals how Taylor Swift constantly inspires him to be better.
How could she not?
So that's one of the plot lines for the Super Bowl this Sunday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Points Guy founder Brian Kelly has a new book. In it, he writes about how to maximize your travel dollars. Travel tips from the Points Guy next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Bonobos might be mind readers. A study suggests these great apes can tell when humans are clueless. When a researcher couldn't see where a snack was placed, the bonobos eagerly pointed it out. If they thought the researcher did have a clue, they just sat back and waited. Scientists say this adds to the debate over whether humans are the only ones with a theory of mind. And either way, they aren't just monkeying around. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Federal agencies in turmoil under the Trump administration include the National Institutes of Health. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is tracking the world's leading public funder of biomedical research. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so how has the NIH been affected?
Well, at the moment, there's just a lot of confusion, anxiety, and I'd say fear. The scientists and doctors on the sprawling campus just outside Washington have been under a blackout of most communications like other health agencies, but we do know that a ban had been imposed on travel, forcing cancellation of some important meetings about what to fund next to fight diseases like, you know, cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. Most NIH scientists I reached out to are still afraid to speak publicly. One exception is Haley Chatelain. She's a young researcher looking at basic cellular functions who helps bargain for the union representing 5,000 NIH fellows.
It's a huge deal. Science moves at breakneck speeds and requires that all of us in the scientific community work together. Any gap that we experience sets us back in terms of being able to conduct the cutting-edge biomedical research that Americans need to stay healthy.
Now, the NIH released a statement last night saying the communications blackout has started to lift a little, and some meetings and travel are resuming, so some things seem to be easing up.
Okay, what things are not easing up?
Well, there's still a hiring freeze, a prohibition on starting any new research projects on the NIH's campus, and a pause on recruiting new patients for any clinical studies at the NIH. Marjorie Levenstein's another postdoctoral fellow at NIH with the union. She studies addiction, among other things, and says she had to put aside a big step in her research.
It's incredibly frustrating. It's really harming our ability to make huge medical breakthroughs.
Now, the NIH spends most of the agency's nearly $48 billion annual budget on funding tens of thousands of researchers outside the agency, you know, at universities, hospitals, and medical centers. So far, the NIH funding spigot appears to remain open, but there's still worries about the future, so some institutions have started tightening their belts.
As I'm listening, Rob, I'm thinking about the debate over USAID. Agency for International Development. Yeah. Some people have been outraged and said, this is illegal, what's happening? Other people have said, actually, I have a critique of this agency. So how are people responding to the concerns about NIH?
You know, Steve, even the NIH's biggest fans say the agency is far from perfect. You know, some changes have been under consideration for a while, like making, you know, the grant review process better. But the main feeling I'm hearing now is a sense of foreboding. I talked with Dr. Harold Varmus at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York. He ran the NIH for 6 years in the 1990s.
There's been a general theme to Mr. Trump's ascension to the presidency that this new administration is going to be somehow waging war on the health agencies, and it's going to have a tremendously detrimental effect on the health sciences. All of these are terrible signs that we need to be confronting vigorously.
Rob, I'm just going to note the administration's leadership for health is not yet in place, although he's nominated two critics of the NIH.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is under consideration to take over the HHS, the Health and Human Services Department, which oversees the NIH, and Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, a Stanford researcher who was critical of the NIH during the pandemic, is Trump's pick to take over as the next NIH director. His confirmation hearing hasn't been scheduled quite yet. So all in all, there's just a lot of uncertainty and apprehension right now about the future of the NIH.
That's NPR's Rob Stein here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Thank you.
If Congress votes to spend, can a president unspend?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers comprehensive cybersecurity protection while automating cyber defense to stop threats so organizations can thrive. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com. And by Amazon Business, focused on offering smart business buying solutions, leading time to focus on growth. More at amazonbusiness.com.
For Marketplace, I'm Novosafo, in for David Brancaccio. First, President Trump says he's creating a sovereign wealth fund, which could, maybe, buy TikTok. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
A sovereign wealth fund invests government money in things like real estate, stocks, and bonds. Other countries like Saudi Arabia and Norway have sovereign wealth funds where they invest their government surpluses from sales of oil and gas. But the U.S. has a deficit. It's not clear where the money for a sovereign wealth fund would come from. Congress would probably need to authorize funding for it, and that would take time. TikTok needs to find a new owner by this April. And TikTok users are also skeptical of government control of the platform. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Staying with the power of the purse in America and the question of whether the president and his people can freeze money that's been authorized by Congress, it's about the Constitution and something called the Impoundment Control Act of 1974. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains.
For a chaotic, confusing couple of days last week, it looked like the Trump administration was about to halt federal spending on all sorts of programs, including possibly housing vouchers, low-income heating assistance, Medicaid, Head Start. But after widespread outrage, lawsuits, and two court orders, the Office of Management and Budget rescinded its memo ordering that spending freeze.
Congress authorized that money to be spent. And it is not up to the president to decide, I don't want to spend it.
Sally Katzen at New York University School of Law says the Constitution gives Congress what's called the power of the purse, not the president.
And that means that when Congress has appropriated funds, they should be spent on what Congress had in mind.
In addition to the Constitution, David Super at Georgetown Law School says there's also the Impoundment Control Act of 1974.
The Impoundment Control Act was something that Congress passed during the Nixon administration to deal with his desire to impound or refuse to spend money that Congress had directed him to spend.
Much like Trump, President Richard Nixon didn't want to spend money on certain social and environmental programs that Congress had approved, so he just refused to spend it.
He was sued over that. He lost all the cases that were decided on the merits, including 9-0 in the Supreme Court. But Congress decided to pass a law giving him a legitimate path to propose impounding or not spending money.
That law, the Impoundment Control Act, says if the president doesn't want to spend money on, say, food stamps or upgrading infrastructure or foreign aid for whatever reason, he must go back to Congress and ask them to reconsider. But so far, Trump hasn't done that. And even though OMB rescinded its now infamous memo last week, Samuel Bagenstos at the University of Michigan Law School says the administration is currently withholding certain funding, including for green energy projects and foreign aid.
All of this was based on the same theory that President Trump wants to decide if this spending is consistent with his policy preferences, and that's not something that is a proper reason under our Constitution and laws to pause or withhold spending that Congress has adopted.
At a press conference House and Senate Democrats held Monday afternoon, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota called the president's withholding of funds a constitutional crisis.
We have the power of the purse. We get to decide where money is allocated, and it's the executive's power to make sure that that money gets to where it needs to get.
And right now, that's not what's happening. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The numbers, the Dow is up, but just barely 0.1%. The S&P 500 index is up 0.6%. The NASDAQ composite index is up 1.1%. The trade war is on with China, which announced its move given Trump hiking tariffs 10%. China is going with 15% on liquefied natural gas and coal, and 10% on American farm equipment, some cars, and oil imports.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company harnessing innovation and technology to connect advertisers with consumers. Clear Channel's data-driven solutions reach consumers on the go. Billboardsforbusiness.com. And by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com. And by Glassdoor, Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life, all on the Glassdoor app.
Climate change may have made the Los Angeles wildfires burn hotter and longer, and now there's new analysis on how a changing climate may impact the value of homes in the future. It comes from the nonprofit First Street Foundation. Its analysis finds that the overall value of real estate could shrink by $1.5 trillion over 30 years. Marketplace's Henry Yap reports.
On the whole, property values in the U.S. are likely to keep rising in the coming decades, but climate change will limit that growth, says Jeremy Porter at the First Street Foundation.
It's really lost appreciation or lost value over the next 30 years.
That loss won't be felt evenly, he says. Housing markets in areas with weaker economies like the Rust Belt could take a bigger hit. Meanwhile, markets like Los Angeles, Miami, and Houston, which face strong climate hazards, could actually keep growing.
They also have a lot of amenities, and right now those amenities are outweighing the disamenities of climate risk, and people are still moving to those areas.
That could keep pushing up home insurance rates. One way to mitigate that is to build and retrofit homes to make them more resilient to hurricanes and wildfires, says Michael Newman with the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety.
Yes, it may cost a few $1,000s more, and I'm not underselling what that means for many families, but that can lead to longer term savings over time for them.
States and cities can also encourage development in places people are likely to migrate to, says A.R. Siders at the University of Delaware.
If we do this proactively, we can actually give people a lot more options.
But whether communities across the country are up to that task, Siders says, is an open question. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
The latest data just in from the Labor Department shows job openings fell again in December after a brief spike last fall. They're down to 7.5 million, which is still higher than pre-COVID times. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.